his features rigid as though he struggled within himself. The fat man was playing upon the whole audience without the least show of exertion. He seemed completely composed, hidden behind his black-lensed glasses, only his mobile features gesturing his vocal drama. I nudged the boy beside me. "Who is he?" I whispered. He gave me a look of annoyance, almost of outrage. "Reverend Homer A. Bobby, Chicago," he said. Now the speaker rested his arm upon the lectern and turned toward Dr. Bledsoe. "You've heard the bright beginning of the beautiful story, my friends. But there is the mournful ending, and perhaps, in many ways, the richer side. The setting of this glorious sun of the morning." He turned to Dr. Bledsoe. "It was a fateful day, Dr. Bledsoe, sir, if I may recall it to you. For we were there. Oh, yes, my young friends," he said, turning to face us again with a sad, proud smile. "I knew him well, and loved him, and I was there. We had toured through several states to which he was carrying the message. The people had come to hear the prophet. The multitude had responded. The old-fashioned people, women in aprons and Mother Hubbards of calico and gingham, men in their overalls and patched alpacas, a sea of upturned and puzzled faces looking out from beneath old battered straw hats and limp sunbonnets. They who had come by oxen and mule team and by walking long distances. It was the month of September, and unseasonably cold. He had spoken peace and confidence into their troubled souls, had set a star before them, and we were passing on to other scenes, still carrying the message. Ah, those days of ceaseless travel, those youthful days, those springtime days, fertile, blossomy, sun-filled days of promise. Ah, yes, those indescribably glorious days in which the Founder was building the dream, not only here in this then barren valley, but hither and yonder throughout the land, instilling the dream in the hearts of the people, erecting the scaffolding of a nation, broadcasting his message that fell like seed on fallow ground, sacrificing himself, fighting and forgiving his enemies of both complexions. Oh, yes, he had them of both complexions. But going forward, filled with the importance of his message, filled with his dedicated mission, and in his zeal, perhaps in his mortal pride, ignoring the advice of his physician. I see in my mind's eye the fatal atmosphere of that jam-packed auditorium. The Founder holds the audience within the gentle palm of his eloquence, rocking it, soothing it, instructing it, and there below the rapt faces blushed by the glow of the big pot-belly stove, now turned cherry red with its glowing. Yes, the spellbound rose caught in the imperious truth of his message. And I hear now again the great humming hush as his voice reached the end of a mighty period. And one of the listeners, a snowy-headed man, leaps to his feet, crying out, "Tell us what is to be done, sir. For God's sake, tell us. Tell us in the name of the son they snatched from me last week." And all through the room, the voices arising, imploring, "Tell us. Tell us." And the Founder is suddenly mute with tears. Old Barbie's voice rang out as suddenly he made charged and incomplete movements about the platform, acting out his words. And I watched with a sick fascination, knowing part of the story, yet a part of me fighting against its sad, inevitable conclusion. And the Founder pauses, then steps forward with his eyes spilling his great emotion. With his arm upraised, he begins to answer, and totters. Then all is commotion. We rush forward and lead him away. The audience leaps to its feet in consternation. All is terror and turmoil, a moan and a sighing, until like a clap of thunder I hear Dr. Bledsoe's voice ring out, whip-like with authority, a song of hope. And as we stretch the founder upon a bench to rest, I hear Dr. Bledsoe stomping out the time with mighty strokes upon the hollow platform, commanding not in words but in the great gut tones of his magnificent basso. Oh, but wasn't he a singer? Isn't he a singer still today? And they stand, they come, and with him they sing out against the tottering of their giants, sing out their long, black songs of blood and bones, meaning hope, of hardship and pain, meaning faith, of humbleness and absurdity, meaning endurance, of ceaseless struggle in darkness, meaning triumph. Ha! Barbie cried, slapping his hands. Ha! Singing verse after verse until the leader revived. Slap, slap of his hands. Address them, slap. My God, assure them, slap. That slap, he was only tired of his ceaseless efforts. Yes, and dismisses them, sending each on his way, rejoicing, giving each a parting handshake of fellowship. I watched Barbie pace in a semicircle, his lips compressed, his face working with emotion, his palms kneading and making no sound. Ah, those days in which he tilled his mighty fields, those days in which he watched the crops take hold and grow, those youthful, summery, sun-bright days. Barbie's voice sighed off in nostalgia. The chapel hardly breathed as he sighed deeply. Then I watched him produce a snowy handkerchief, remove his dark glasses and wipe his eyes, and through the increasing distance of my isolation, I watched the men in the seats of honor slowly shake their spellbound heads. Then Barbie's voice began again, disembodied now, and it was as though he had never paused, as though his words, reverberating within us, had continued their rhythmic flow, though their source was for a moment stilled. Oh, yes, my young friends. Oh, yes, he continued with great sadness. Man's hope can paint a purple picture, can transform a soaring vulture into a noble eagle or a moaning dove. Oh, yes, but I know, he shouted, startling me. In spite of that great, anguished hope within me, I know. No, that great spirit was declining, was approaching its lonely winter, the great sun going down. For sometimes it is given one to know these things. And I staggered under the awful burden of that knowledge, and I cursed myself because I bore it. But such was the founder's enthusiasm, oh yes, that as we sped from country town to country town through the glorious Indian summer, I soon forgot. And then, I listened to his voice fall to a whisper. His hands were outspread as though he were leading an orchestra into a profound and final diminuendo. Then his voice rose again, crisply, almost matter-of-factly accelerated. I remember the start of the train, how it seemed to groan as it started up the steep grade into the mountain. It was cold. Frost formed its icy patterns upon the window's edges, and the whistle of the train was long-drawn and lonely, a sigh issuing from the depths of the mountain. In the car up ahead, in the Pullman assigned him by the very president of the line, the leader lay tossing. He had been struck with a sudden and mysterious sickness, and I knew, in spite of the anguish within me, that the sun goeth down, for the heavens themselves conveyed that knowledge. The rush of the train, the clicking of the wheels upon the steel, I remember how I looked out of the frosted pane and saw the looming great North Star and lost it, as though the sky had shut its eye. The train was curving the mountain, the engine loping like a great black hound, parallel with the last careening cars, panting forth its pale white vapor as it hurled us ever higher, and shortly the sky was black without a moon, and his moon echoed over the chapel. He drew his chin against his chest until his white collar disappeared, leaving him a figure of balanced, unbroken blackness, and I could hear the rasp of air as he inhaled. It was as though the very constellations knew our impending sorrow. He bugled, his head raised to the ceiling, his voice full-throated, for against that great, wide sweep of sable there came the burst of a single jewel-like star, and I saw it shimmer and break and streak down the cheek of that cold black sky like a reluctant and solitary tear. He shook his head with great emotion, his lips pursed as he moaned, turning toward Dr. Bledsoe as though he did not quite see him. At that fateful moment, I sat with your great president. He was deep in meditation as we awaited word from the men of science, and he said to me of that dying star, Barbie, friend, did you see? And I answered, yes, doctor, I saw. And at our throats already, we felt the cold hands of sorrow. And I said to Dr. Bledsoe, let us pray. And as we knelt there on the swaying floor, our words were less prayers than sounds of mute and terrible sorrow. And it was then, as we pulled to our feet, staggering with the motion of that speeding train, that we saw the physician moving toward us, and we looked with bated breath into the blank and expressionless features of the man of science, asking with our total beings, do you bring us hope or disaster? And it was then and there he informed us that the leader was nearing his destination. It was said. The cruel blow had fallen and we were left numb. But the founder was still, for the moment, with us and still in command. And of all in the traveling party he sent for him, who sits there, before you, and for me, as a man of God. But he wanted mainly his friend of midnight consultations, his comrade of many battles, who over the weary years had remained steadfast in defeat as in victory. Even now I can see it, the dark passage lit with dim lights, and Dr. Bledsoe swaying as he went before me. At the door stood the porter and the conductor, a black man and a white man of the South, both crying, both weeping. And he looked up as we entered, his great eyes resigned, but still aflame with nobility and courage against the white of his pillow, and he looked at his friend and smiled warmly at his old campaigner, his loyal champion, his adjunct, that marvelous singer of the old songs who had rallied his spirit during times of distress and discouragement, who, with his singing of the old familiar melodies, soothed the doubts and fears of the multitude, who had rallied the ignorant, the fearful and suspicious, those still wrapped in the rags of slavery, him, there, your leader, who calmed the children of the storm. And as the founder looked up at his companion, he smiled, and reaching out his hand to his friend and companion, as I now stretch out my hand to you, he said, come closer. Come closer. And he moved closer until he stood beside the berth, and the light slanting across his shoulder as he knelt beside him. And the hand reached out and gently touched him, and he said, now, you must take on the burden. Lead them the rest of the way. And oh, the cry of that train and the pain too big for tears. when the train reached the summit of the mountain, he was no longer with us. And as the train dropped down the grade, he had departed. It had become a veritable train of sorrow. Dr. Bledsoe there sat, weary in mind and heavy of heart. What should he do? The leader was dead, and he, thrown suddenly at the head of the troops, like a cavalryman catapulted into the saddle of his general felled in a charge of battle, vaulted onto the back of his fiery and half-broken charger. Ah, and that great, black, noble beast, wall-eyed with the din of battle and twitching already with its sense of loss. What command should he give? Should he return with his burden home to where already the hot wires were flashing, speaking, rattling the mournful message? Should he turn and bear the fallen soldier down the cold and alien mountain to this valley home? Return with the dear eyes dulled, the firm hands still, the magnificent voice silent, the leader cold? Return to the warm valley, to the green grounds he could no longer light with his mortal vision? Should he follow his leader's vision, though he had now himself departed? Ah, of course, you know the story, how he bore the body into the strange city and the speech he made as his leader lay in state, and how when the sad news spread, a day of mourning was declared for the whole municipality. Oh, and how rich and poor, black and white, weak and powerful, young and old, all came to pay their homage, many realizing the leader's worth and their loss only now with his passing. And how, with his mission done, Dr. Bledsoe returned, keeping his sorrowful vigil with his friend in an humble baggage car, and how the people came to pay their respects at the stations. A slow train, a sorrowful train, and all along the line in the mountain and valley, wherever the rails found their fateful course, the people were one in their common mourning, and like the cold steel rails were spiked down to their sorrow. Oh, what a sad departure. And what an even sadder arrival. See with me, my young friends, hear with me the weeping and wailing of those who shared his labors. Their sweet leader returned to them rock cold in the iron immobility of death, he who had left them quick in the prime of his manhood, author of their own fire and illumination, returned to them cold, already a bronzed statue. Oh, the despair, my young friends, the black despair of black people. I see them now, wandering about these grounds, where each brick, each bird, each blade of grass was a reminder of some precious memory, and each memory a hammer stroke driving home the blunt spikes of their sorrow. Oh, yes, some now are here, gray-haired among you, still dedicated to his vision, still laboring in the vineyard. But then, with the black, draped coffin lying in state among them, inescapably reminding them, they felt the dark night of slavery settling once more upon them. They smelt that old, obscene stink of darkness, that old slavery smell, worse than the rank halitosis of hoary death. Their sweet light enclosed in a black-draped coffin, their majestic sun snatched behind a cloud. Oh, and the sad sound of weeping bugles, I can hear them now, stationed at the four corners of the campus, sounding taps for the fallen general, announcing and re-announcing the sad tidings, telling and retelling the sad revelation one to the other across the still numbness of the air, as though they could not believe it, could neither comprehend nor accept it. Bugles weeping like a family of tender women lamenting their loved one. And the people came to sing the old songs and to express their unspeakable sorrow. Black, 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 black people in blacker mourning. The funeral crepe hung upon their naked hearts, singing unashamedly their black folks' songs of sorrow. Moving painfully, overflowing the curving walks, weeping and wailing beneath the drooping trees and their low, murmuring voices like the moans of winds in a wilderness. And finally they gathered on the hill slope, and as far as the tear-wet eyes could see, they stood with their heads bowed, singing. Then, silence. The lonesome hole banked with poignant flowers, the dozen white-gloved hands waiting taut upon the silken ropes, that awful silence. The final words are spoken. A single wild rose tossed farewell bursts slowly, its petals drifting snow-like upon the reluctantly lowered coffin, then down into the earth, back to the ancient dust, back to the cold black clay, mother of us all. As Barbie paused, the silence was so complete that I could hear the power engines far across the campus throbbing the night like an excited pulse. Somewhere in the audience, an old woman's voice began a plaintive wail, the birth of a sad, unformulated song that died stillborn in a sob. Barbie stood with his head thrown back, his arms rigid at his sides, his fists clenched as though fighting desperately for control. Dr. Bledsoe sat with his face in his hands. Near me, someone blew his nose. Barbie took a tottering step forward. "Oh, yes, oh, yes," he said. "Oh, yes, that, too, is part of the glorious story. But think of it not as a death, but as a birth. A great seed had been planted, a seed which has continued to put forth its fruit in its season as surely as if the great Creator had been resurrected. For in a sense, he was, if not in the flesh, in the spirit. And in a sense, in the flesh, too, for has not your present leader become his living agent, his physical presence? Look about you if you doubt it, my young friends, my dear young friends. How can I tell you what manner of man this is who leads you? How can I convey to you how well he has kept his pledge to the founder, how conscientious has been his stewardship? First, you must see the school as it was, already a great institution, to be sure, but then the buildings were 8. Now they are 20. Then the faculty was 50. Now it is 200. Then the student body was a few hundred, where now I'm told you are 3,000. And now, where you have roads of asphalt for the passage of rubber tires, then the roads were of crushed stone for the passage of oxen and mule teams and horse-drawn wagons. I have not words to tell you how my heart swelled to return to this great institution after so great a while, to move among its wealth of green things, its fruitful farmland and fragrant campus. Ah! And the marvelous plant supplying power to an area larger than many towns, all operated by black hands. Thus, my young friends, does the light of the founder still burn. Your leader has kept his promise 1,000-fold. I commend him in his own right, for he is the co-architect of a great and noble experiment. He is a worthy successor to his great friend, and it is no accident that his great and intelligent leadership has made him our leading statesman. His is a form of greatness worthy of your imitation. I say to you, pattern yourselves upon him, aspire, each of you, to someday follow in his footsteps. Great deeds are yet to be performed, for we are a young, though a fast-rising people. Legends are still to be created. Be not afraid, one, to take the burdens of your leader, and the work of the founder will be one of every unfolding glory, the history of the race, a saga of mounting triumphs. Bobby stood with his arms outstretched now, beaming over the audience, his Buddha-like body still as an onyx boulder. There was sniffling throughout the chapel. Voices murmured with admiration, and I felt more lost than ever. For a few minutes, old Bobby had made me see the vision, and now I knew that leaving the campus would be like the parting of flesh. I watched him lower his arms now and start back to his chair, moving slowly with his head cocked as though listening to distant music. I'd lowered my head to wipe my eyes when I heard the shocked gasp arise. Looking up, I saw two of the white trustees moving swiftly across the platform to where Barbie floundered upon Dr. Bledsoe's legs. The old man slid forward upon his hands and knees as the two white men took his arms, and now, as he stood, I saw one of them reach for something on the floor and place it in his hands. It was when he raised his head that I saw it. For a swift instant, between the gesture and the opaque glitter of his glasses, I saw the blinking of sightless eyes. Homer A. Barbie was blind. Uttering apologies, Dr. Bledsoe helped him to his chair. Then, as the old man rested back with a smile, Dr. Bledsoe walked to the edge of the platform and lifted his arms. I closed my eyes as I heard the deep moaning sound that issued from him, and the rising crescendo of the student body joining in. This time, it was music, sincerely felt, not rendered for the guests, but for themselves, a song of hope and exaltation. I wanted to rush from the building, but didn't dare. I sat stiff and erect, supported by the hard bench, relying upon it as upon a form of hope. I could not look at Dr. Bledsoe now, because old Barbie had made me both feel my guilt and accept it. For although I had not intended it, any act that endangered the continuity of the dream was an act of treason. I did not listen to the next speaker, a tall white man who kept dabbing his eyes with a handkerchief and repeating his phrases in an emotional and inarticulate manner. Then the orchestra played excerpts from Dvorak's New World Symphony, and I kept hearing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot resounding through its dominant theme, my mother's and grandfather's favorite spiritual. It was more than I could stand. And before the next speaker could begin, I hurried past the disapproving eyes of teachers and matrons out into the night. A mockingbird trilled a note from where it perched upon the hand of the moonlit founder, flipping its moon-mad tail above the head of the eternally kneeling slave. I went up the shadowy drive, heard it trill behind me. The street lamps glowed brilliant in the moonlit dream of the campus, each light serene in its cage of shadows. I might well have waited until the end of the services, for I hadn't gone far when I heard the dim, bright notes of the orchestra striking up a march, followed by a burst of voices as the students filed out into the night. With a feeling of dread, I headed for the administration building, and upon reaching it, stood in the darkened doorway. My mind fluttered like the moths that veiled the street lamp, which cast shadows upon the bank of grass below me. I would now have my real interview with Dr. Bledsoe, and I recalled Barbie's address with resentment. With such words fresh in his mind, I was sure Dr. Bledsoe would be far less sympathetic to my plea. I stood in the darkened doorway trying to probe my future if I were expelled. Where would I go would I do? How could I ever return home? Down the sloping lawn below me, the male students moved toward their dormitories, seeming far away from me now, remote, and each shadowy form vastly superior to me, who had by some shortcoming cast myself into the darkness away from all that was worthwhile and inspiring. I listened to one group harmonize quietly as they passed. The smell of the fresh bread being prepared in the bakery drifted to me. The good white bread of breakfast, the rolls dripping with yellow butter that I had slipped into my pocket so often to be munched later in my room with wild blackberry jam from home. Lights began to appear in the girls' dormitories, like the bursting of luminous seeds flung broadside by an invisible hand. Several cars rolled by. I saw a group of old women who lived in the town approaching. One used a cane, which from time to time she tapped hollowly upon the walk like a blind man. Snatches of their conversation flooded to me as they discussed Barbie's talk with enthusiasm, recalled the times of the founder, their quavering voices weaving and embroidering his story. Then, down the long avenue of trees, I saw the familiar Cadillac approaching and started inside the building, suddenly filled with panic. I hadn't gone 2 steps before I turned and hurried out into the night again. I couldn't stand to face Dr. Bledsoe immediately. I was fairly shivering as I fell in behind a group of boys going up the drive. They were arguing some point heatedly, but I was too agitated to listen and simply followed in their shadows, noticing the dull gleam of their polished shoe leather in the rays of the street lamps. I kept trying to formulate what I would say to Dr. Bledsoe, and the boys must have turned into their building, for suddenly finding myself outside the gates of the campus and heading down the highway, I turned and ran back to the building. When I went in, he was wiping his neck with a blue-bordered handkerchief. The shaded lamp, catching the lenses of his glasses, left half of his broad face in the shadow as his clenched fists stretched full forth in the light before him. I stood, hesitating in the door, aware suddenly of the old, heavy furnishings, the relics from the times of the founder, the framed portrait photographs and relief plaques of presidents and industrialists, men of power, fixed like trophies or heraldic emblems upon the walls. "Come in," he said from the half-shadow. Then I saw him move and his head coming forward, his eyes burning. He began mildly, as if quietly joking, throwing me off balance. "Boy," he said, "I understand that you not only carried Mr. Norton out to the quarters, but that you wound up at that sinkhole, that Golden Day." It was a statement, not a question. I said nothing, and he looked at me with the same mild gaze. Had Barbie helped Mr. Norton soften him? "No," he said. "It wasn't enough to take him to the quarters. You had to make the complete tour to give him the full treatment. Was that it?"
"No, sir. I mean that he was ill, sir," I said. "He had to have some whiskey."
"And that was the only place you knew to go," he said. "So you went there because you were taking care of him?"
"Yes, sir."
"And not only that," he said in a voice that both mocked and marveled, "you took him out and sat him down on the gallery, veranda, piazza, whatever they call it nowadays, and introduced him to the quality."
"Quality?" I frowned. "Oh, but he insisted that I stop, sir. There was nothing I could do."
"Of course," he said, "of course."
"He was interested in the cabin, sir. He was surprised that there were any left."
"So naturally you stopped," he said, bowing his head again.
"Yes, sir."
"Yes, and I suppose the cabin opened up and told its life history and all the choice gossip." I started to explain. "Boy," he exploded, "are you serious? Why were you out there on the road in the first place? Weren't you behind the wheel?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then haven't we bowed and scraped and begged and lied enough decent homes and drives for you to show him? Did you think that white man had to come 1,000 miles all the way from New York and Boston and Philadelphia just for you to show him a slum? Don't just stand there. Say something."
"But I was only driving him, sir. I only stopped there after he ordered me to."
"Ordered you?" he said. "He ordered you? Damn it, white folk are always giving orders. It's a habit with them. Why didn't you make an excuse? Couldn't you say they had a sickness, smallpox, or picked another cabin? Why, that True Blood shack. My God, boy, you're black and living in the South. Did you forget how to lie?"
"Lie, sir? Lie to him? Lie to a trustee, sir? Me?
He shook his head with a kind of anguish. And me thinking I'd picked a boy with a brain, he said.
Didn't you know you were endangering the school? But I was only trying to please him. Please him! And here you are, junior in college. Why, the dumbest black bastard in the cotton patch knows that the only way to please a white man is to tell him a lie. What kind of education are you getting around here? Who really told you to take him out there? He said.
He did, sir. No one else.
Don't lie to me. That's the truth, sir. I warn you now. Who suggested it?
I swear, sir, no one told me.
Nigger, this isn't the time to lie. I'm no white man. Tell me the truth.
It was as though he'd struck me. I stared across the desk thinking, he called me that?
Answer me, boy!
That? I thought, noticing the throbbing of a vein that rose between his eyes, thinking, he called me that? I wouldn't lie, sir, I said.
Then who was that patient you were talking with?
I never saw him before, sir.
What was he saying?
I can't recall at all, I muttered. The man was raving.
Speak up. What did he say?
He thinks that he lived in France and that he's a great doctor.
Continue.
He said that I believed that White was right, I said.
What?
Suddenly his face twitched and cracked like the surface of dark water.
And you do, don't you?
Dr. Bledsoe said, suppressing a nasty laugh.
Well, don't you?
I did not answer, thinking, you? You?
Who was he? Did you ever see him before?
No, sir, I hadn't.
Was he northern or southern?
I don't know, sir. He struck his desk.
College for Negroes. Boy, what do you know other than how to ruin an institution in half an hour that it took over a half a hundred years to build? Did he talk northern or southern?
He talked like a white man, I said, except that his voice sounded southern, like one of ours.
I'll have him investigated, he said. A Negro like that should be under lock and key.
Across the campus, a clock struck the quarter hour, and something inside me seemed to muffle its sound. I turned to him desperately. Dr. Bledsoe, I'm awfully sorry. I had no intention of going there, but things just got out of hand. Mr. Norton understands how it happened.
Listen to me, boy, he said loudly. Norton is one man, and I'm another, and while he might think he's satisfied, I know that he isn't. Your poor judgment has caused this school incalculable damage. Instead of uplifting the race, you've torn it down.
He looked at me as though I had committed the worst crime imaginable.
Don't you know we can't tolerate such a thing? I gave you an opportunity to serve one of our best white friends, a man who could make your fortune, but in return you drag the entire race into the slime.
Suddenly he reached for something beneath a pile of papers, an old leg shackle from slavery, which he proudly called a symbol of our progress.
You've got to be disciplined, boy, he said. There's no ifs and ands about it.
But you gave Mr. Norton your word.
Don't stand there and tell me what I already know. Regardless of what I said, as the leader of this institution, I can't possibly let this pass. Boy, I'm getting rid of you.
It must have happened when the metal struck the desk, for suddenly I was leaning toward him, shouting with outrage.
I'll tell him, I said. I'll go to Mr. Norton and tell him. You've lied to both of us. What?
He said,
you have the nerve to threaten me in my own office? I'll tell him, I screamed. I'll tell everybody. I'll fight you. I swear, I'll fight you. Well, he said, sitting back, well, I'll be damned.
For a moment, he looked me up and down, and I saw his head go back into the shadow, hearing a high, thin sound like a cry of rage. Then his face came forward, and I saw his laughter. For an instant I stared, then I wheeled and started for the door, hearing him sputter,
wait,
behind me. I turned. He gasped for breath, propping his huge head up with his hands as tears streamed down his face.
Come on, come, he said, removing his glasses and wiping his eyes. Come on, son,
his voice amused and conciliatory. It was as though I was being put through a fraternity initiation and found myself going back. He looked at me, still laughing with agony, his eyes burned.
Boy, you are a fool, he said. Your white folk didn't teach you anything, and your mother wit has left you cold. What has happened to you young Negroes? I thought you had caught on to how things are done down here, but you don't even know the difference between the way things are and the way they're supposed to be. My God, he gasped. What is the race coming to? Why, boy, You can tell anyone you like. Sit down there. Sit down, sir, I say.
Reluctantly, I sat, torn between anger and fascination, hating myself for obeying.
Tell anyone you like, he said. I don't care. I wouldn't raise my little finger to stop you, because I don't owe anyone a thing, son.
Who?
Negroes? Negroes don't control this school or much of anything else. Haven't you learned even that? No, sir, they don't control this school nor white folk either. True, they support it, but I control it. I's big and black, and I say, yes, sir, as loudly as any burrhead when it's convenient. But I'm still the king down here. I don't care how much it appears otherwise. Power doesn't have to show off. Power is confident, self-assuring, self-starting, and self-stopping, self-warming, and self-justifying. When you have it, you know it. Let the Negroes snicker and the crackers laugh. Those are the facts, son. The only ones I even pretend to please are big white folk, and even those I control more than they control me. This is a power setup, son, and I'm at the controls. You think about that. When you buck against me, you're bucking against power, rich white folks' power, the nation's power, which means government power.
He paused to let it sink in, and I waited, feeling a numb, violent outrage.
And I'll tell you something your sociology teachers are afraid to tell you, he said. If there weren't men like me running schools like this, there'd be no South, nor North either, no. And there'd be no country, not as it is today. You think about that, son. He laughed. With all your speech-making and studying, I thought you understood something. But you... All right, go ahead, C. Norton. You'll find that he wants you disciplined. He might not know it, but he does, because he knows that I know what is best for his interests. You're a black-educated fool, son. These white folks have newspapers, magazines, radios, spokesmen to get their ideas across. If they want to tell the world a lie, they can tell it so well that it becomes the truth. And if I tell them that you're lying, they'll tell the world, even if you prove you're telling the truth, because it's the kind of lie they want to hear.
I heard the high, thin laugh again.
You're nobody, son. You don't exist. Can't you see that? The white folk tell everybody what to think, except men like me. I tell them that's my life, telling white folk how to think about the things I know about. Shocks you, doesn't it? Well, that's the way it is. It's a nasty deal, and I don't always like it myself, but you listen to me. I didn't make it, and I know that I can't change it, but I've made my place in it, and I'll have every Negro in the country hanging on tree limbs by morning if it means staying where I am.
He was looking me in the eye now, his voice charged and sincere, as though uttering a confession, a fantastic revelation which I could neither believe nor deny. Cold drops of sweat moved at a glacier's pace down my spine.
I mean it, son, he said. I had to be strong and purposeful to get where I am. I had to wait and plan and lick around. Yes, I had to act the nigger, he said, adding another fiery, yes. I don't even insist that it was worth it, but now I'm here and I mean to stay. After you win the game, you take the prize and you keep it. Protect it. There's nothing else to do, he shrugged. A man gets old winning his place, son, so you go ahead. Go tell your story. Match your truth against my truth, because what I've said is the truth, the broader truth. Test it. Try it out. When I started out, I was a young fella,
but I no longer listened, nor saw more than the play of light upon the metallic discs of his glasses, which now seemed to float within the disgusting sea of his words. Truth. Truth? What was truth? Nobody I knew, not even my mother, would believe me if I tried to tell them. Nor would I tomorrow, I thought, nor would I. I gazed helplessly at the grain of the desk, then passed his head to the case of loving cups behind his chair. Above the case of portrait of the founder looked non-committally down.
Bledsoe laughed. Your arms are too short to box with me, son, and I haven't had to really clip a young Negro in years. No, he said, getting up. They haven't been so cocky as they used to.
This time I could barely move. My stomach was knotted and my kidneys ached. My legs were rubbery. For 3 years I had thought of myself as a man, and here with a few words he'd made me as helpless as an infant. I pulled myself up.
Wait, hold on a second,
he said, looking at me like a man about to flip a coin.
I like your spirit, son. You're a fighter, and I like that. You just lack judgment, though lack of judgment can ruin you. That's why I have to penalize you, son. I know how you feel, too. You don't want to go home to be humiliated. I understand that, because you have some vague notions about dignity. In spite of me, such notions seep in along with the gym-crack teachers and the northern-trained idealists. Yes, and you have some white folk backing you, and you don't want to face them, because nothing is worse for a black man than to be humiliated by white folk. I know all about that, too. Old Doc's been buked and scorned and all of that. I don't just sing about it in chapel. I know about it, but you'll get over it. It's foolish and expensive and a lot of dead weight. You let the white folk worry about pride and dignity. You learn where you are and get yourself power, influence, contacts with power and influential people, then stay in the dark and use it.
How long will I stand here and let him laugh at me, I thought, holding on to the back of the chair. How long?
You're a nervy little fighter, son, he said. And the race needs good, smart, disillusioned fighters. Therefore, I'm going to give you a hand. Maybe you'll feel that I'm giving you my left hand after I've struck you with my right, if you think I'm the kind of man who'd lead with his right, which I'm most certainly not. But that's all right, too. Take it or leave it. I want you to go to New York for the summer and save your pride and your money. You go there and earn your next year's fees, understand?
I nodded, unable to speak, whirling about furiously within myself, trying to deal with him to fit what he was saying to what he had said.
I'll give you letters to some of the school's friends to see that you get work, he said, but this time, use your judgment. Keep your eyes open. Get in the swing of things. Then if you make good, perhaps, well, perhaps, it's up to you.
His voice stopped as he stood, tall and black and disc-eyed, huge.
That's all, young man, he said, his tone abrupt, official. You have 2 days in which to close your affairs.
2 days?
2 days, he said.
I went down the steps and up the walk in the dark, making it out of the building just before it bent me double beneath the wisteria that hung from the trees on the rope-like vines. Almost a total disembowelment, and when it paused, I looked up through the trees, arched high and cool above me to see a whirling, double-imaged moon. My eyes were out of focus. I started toward my room, covering one eye with my hand to avoid crashing into trees and lampposts projected into my path. I went on, tasting bile and thankful that it was night with no one to witness my condition. My stomach felt raw. From somewhere across the quiet of the campus, the sound of an old guitar blues plucked from an out-of-tune piano drifted toward me like a lazy, shimmering wave, like the echoed whistle of a lonely train, and my head went over again, against a tree this time, and I could hear it splattering the flowering vines. When I could move, my head started to whirl in a circle. The day's events flowed past. True Blood, Mr. Norton, Dr. Bledsoe, and a golden day swept around my mind in a mad, surreal whirl. I stood in the path holding my eye and trying to push back the day, but each time I floundered upon Dr. Bledsoe's decision, it still echoed in my mind, and it was real and it was final. Whatever my responsibility was for what had occurred, I knew that I would pay for it. I knew that I would be expelled, and the very idea stabbed my insides again. I stood there on the moonlit walk trying to think ahead to its effects, imagining the satisfaction of those who envied my success, the shame and disappointment of my parents. I would never live down my disgrace. My white friends would be disgusted, and I recall the fear that hung over all those who had no protection from powerful whites. How had I come to this? I had kept unswervingly to the path placed before me, had tried to be exactly what I was expected to be, had done exactly what I was expected to do. Yet instead of winning the expected reward, here I was stumbling along, holding on desperately to one of my eyes in order to keep from bursting out my brains against some familiar object swerved into my path by my distorted vision. And now, to drive me wild, I felt suddenly that my grandfather was hovering over me, grinning triumphantly out of the dark. I simply could not endure it. For despite my anguish and anger, I knew of no other way of living, nor other forms of success available to such as me. I was so completely a part of that existence that in the end, I had to make my peace. It was either that or admit that my grandfather had made sense, which was impossible. For though I still believed myself innocent, I saw that the only alternative to permanently facing the world of true blood and the golden day was to accept the responsibility for what had happened. Somehow I convinced myself I had violated the code and thus would have to submit to punishment. Dr. Bledsoe was right, I told myself. He's right. The school and what it stands for have to be protected. There was no other way, and no matter how much I suffered, I would pay my debt as quickly as possible and return to building my career. Back in my room, I counted my savings, some $50, and decided to get to New York as quickly as possible. If Dr. Bledsoe didn't change his mind about helping me get a job, it would be enough to pay my room and board at Men's House, about which I had learned from fellows who lived there during their summer vacations. I would leave in the morning. So while my roommate grinned and mumbled unaware in his sleep, I packed my bags. Next morning I was up before the bugle sounded and already on a bench in Dr. Bledsoe's outer office when he appeared. The jacket of his blue serge suit was open, revealing a heavy gold chain linked between his vest pockets as he moved toward me with a noiseless tread. He passed without seeming to see me. Then as he reached his office door, he said, "I haven't changed my mind about you, boy, and I don't intend to." "Oh, I didn't come for that, sir," I said, seeing him turn quickly, looking down upon me, his eyes quizzical. "Very well, as long as you understand that. Come in and state your business. I have work to do." I waited before the desk, watching him place his Hamburg on an old brass hall tree. Then he sat before me, making a cage of his fingers and nodding for me to begin. My eyes burned and my voice sounded unreal. "I'd like to leave this morning, sir," I said. His eyes retreated.
"Why this morning?" he said. "I gave you until tomorrow. Why the hurry?"
"It isn't hurry, sir, but since I have to leave, I'd like to get going. Staying until tomorrow won't change matters."
"No, it won't," he said. "That's good sense, and you have my permission." "And what else?"
"That's all, sir, except that I want to say that I'm sorry for what I did and that I hold no hard feelings. What I did was unintentional, but I'm in agreement with my punishment." He touched his fingertips together, the thick fingers meeting delicately, his face without expression.
"That's the proper attitude," he said. "In other words, you don't intend to become bitter, is that it?"
"Yes, sir."
"Yes. I can see that you're beginning to learn. That's good. Two things our people must do is accept responsibility for their acts and avoid becoming bitter." His voice rose with the conviction of his chapel speeches. "Son, if you don't become bitter, nothing can stop you from success. Remember that."
"I shall, sir," I said. Then my throat thickened, and I hoped he would bring up the matter of a job himself. Instead, he looked at me impatiently and said,
"Well, I have work to do. My permission is granted."
"Well, sir, I'd like to ask a favor of you."
"Favor," he said shrewdly. "Now that's another matter. What kind of favor?"
"It isn't much, sir. You suggested that you would put me in touch with some of the trustees who would give me a job. I'm willing to do anything."
"Oh, yes," he said. "Yes, of course."
He seemed to think for a moment, his eyes studying the objects on his desk. Then touching the shackle gently with his index finger, he said,
"Very well. When do you intend to leave?"
"By the first bus, if possible, sir."
"Are you packed?"
"Yes, sir."
"Very well. Go get your bags and return here in 30 minutes. My secretary will give you some letters addressed to several friends of the school. One of them will do something for you.
Thanks, sir. Thank you very much, I said as he stood.
That's all right, he said. The school tries to look out for its own. Only one thing more. These letters will be sealed. Don't open them if you want help. White folk are strict about such things. The letters will introduce you and request them to help you with a job. I'll do my best for you, and it isn't necessary for you to open them, understand?
Oh, I wouldn't think of opening them, sir, I said.
Very well. The young lady will have them for you when you return. What about your parents? Have you informed them?
No, sir. It might make them feel too bad if I told them I was expelled, so I plan to write them after I get there and get a job.
I see. Perhaps that is best.
Well, goodbye, sir, I said, extending my hand.
Goodbye, he said.
His hand was large and strangely limp. He pressed a buzzer as I turned to leave. His secretary brushed past me as I went through the door. The letters were waiting when I returned, 7 of them, addressed to men with impressive names. I looked for Mr. Norton's, but his was not among them. Placing them carefully in my inside pocket, I grabbed my bags and hurried for the bus. The station was empty, but the ticket window was open and a porter in a gray uniform was pushing a broom. I bought my ticket and climbed into the bus. There were only 2 passengers seated at the rear of the red and nickel interior, and I suddenly felt that I was dreaming. It was the vet, who gave me a smile of recognition. An attendant sat beside him.
"Welcome, young man," he called. "Imagine Mr. Crenshaw," he said to the attendant. "We have a traveling companion."
"Morning," I said reluctantly. I looked around for a seat away from them, but although the bus was almost empty, only the rear was reserved for us, and there was nothing to do but move back with them. I didn't like it. The vet was too much a part of an experience which I was already trying to blot out of my consciousness. His way of talking to Mr. Norton had been a foreshadowing of my misfortune, just as I had sensed that it would be. Now, having accepted my punishment, I wanted to remember nothing connected with True Blood or the Golden Day. Crenshaw, a much smaller man than Supercargo, said nothing. He was not the type usually sent out to accompany violent cases, and I was glad until I remembered that the only violent thing about the vet was his tongue. His mouth had already gotten me into trouble, and now I hoped he wouldn't turn it upon the white driver. That was apt to get us killed. What was he doing on the bus anyway? God, how had Dr. Bledsoe worked that fast? I stared at the fat man.
"How did your friend Mr. Norton make out?" he asked.
"He's okay," I said.
"No more fainting spells?"
No.
"Did he bawl you out for what happened?"
"He didn't blame me," I said.
"Good. I think I shocked him more than anything else he saw at the Golden Day. I hoped I hadn't caused you trouble. School isn't out so soon, is it?"
"Not quite," I said lightly. "I'm leaving early in order to take a job."
"Wonderful. At home?"
"No. I thought I might make more money in New York."
"New York," he said. "That's not a place. It's a dream. When I was your age, it was Chicago. Now all the little black boys run away to New York, out of the fire and into the melting pot. I can see you after you've lived in Harlem for 3 months. Your speech will change. You'll talk a lot about college. You'll attend lectures at the men's house. You might even meet a few white folks. And listen," he said, leaning close to whisper, "you might even dance with a white girl." "I'm going to New York to work," I said, looking around me. I won't have time for that."
"You will, though," he teased. "Deep down, you're thinking about the freedom you've heard about up north, and you'll try it once, just to see if what you've heard is true."
"There's other kinds of freedom besides some old white trash woman," Crenshaw said. "You might want to see him some shows and eat in some of them big restaurants."
The vet grinned.
Why, of course, but remember, Crenshaw, he's only going to be there a few months. Most of the time he'll be working, and so much of his freedom will have to be symbolic. And what will be his or any man's most easily accessible symbol of freedom? Why, a woman, of course. In 20 minutes he can inflate that symbol with all the freedom which he'll be too busy working to enjoy the rest of the time. He'll see.
I tried to change the subject.
Where are you going? I asked. To Washington, D.C., he said.
Then you're cured.
Cured! There is no cure. He's being transferred, said Crenshaw.
Yes, I'm headed for St. Elizabeth's, the vet said. The ways of authority are indeed mysterious. For a year I've tried to get transferred, then this morning I'm suddenly told to pack. I can't but wonder if our little conversation with your friend, Mr. Norton, had something to do with it.
How could he have anything?